afternoon. On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, Incremental Sampling Methodology Update, Training Modules 4 through 6. My name is Nicole Henderson. I am your moderator today from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. This training is an introduction to the ITRC online guidance document, Incremental Sampling Methodology Update, known as ISM2, produced by ITRC in 2020. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council and is hosted by the US EPA Cleanup Information Network, also known as CLUIN. Some of our housekeeping rules for the day, we do want to let you know that this training is being recorded and will be offered on demand through CLUIN for those not able to join today. The CLUIN training page offers the slides for you to download from under Download Training Materials. Throughout this presentation, we encourage you to use the Q&A pod in the lower right-hand corner to ask questions, make comments, or report technical problems. During the question and answer break, we'll provide directions on how to unmute phones and participate if anybody has joined us through phone line. For those of you that are interested in receiving a certificate of completion for today's training, we will have a feedback form at the end of the training that you can click a box to certify you participated, and the certificate will be emailed to you. The Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council is a program of the Environmental Council of the States. ITRC is a state-led organization composed of over 1,000 members from state agencies, federal government, the private sector, academia, and community stakeholders. ITRC members participate in technical teams, which produce tools, resources, and training courses. Such as the one that you are participating on today. If you'd like to be a part of ITRC, please visit the ITRC website. On the website, you can register for our 2021 teams and learn more about how to be an active ITRC member. Additionally, the full ITRC disclaimer is available on the ITRC website. If you plan to use ITRC materials, we ask that you review that policy in detail and be sure to credit ITRC.
Hi and welcome. I'm Troy Keith from the Tennessee Department of Environment and Conservation and one of the co-leads for ISM2. ITRC issued the Incremental Sampling Methodology Guidance known as ISM1 in February 2012, and since that time many more states and consultants have adopted its use, and we found that it could benefit from an update. What started out as an update really turned into more of a complete overhaul of the original document with input from experts and practitioners across the nation and from even from other countries. The revised and updated ITRC guidance, ISM2, was developed to build on the 2012 version to reflect advancements in technology and to share case studies that simply were unavailable at the time of ISM1 and that provide insight into potential applications, benefits, and challenges of the ISM approach. The ISM2 update team also determined that clarification of incorrect, unclear, or inconsistent information in ISM1 was also necessary. A clarification statement is now appended at the beginning of ISM1, and the ISM1 document continues to be a very useful and valuable tool for those interested in learning the concepts of ISM, and we encourage you to visit that document.
Hello, and thank you for joining us today. My name is Caroline Gelanti, and I'm with the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation. Troy and I serve as the state team leaders for the ISM2 update team, and today we will be your moderators. Throughout the training, we will be introducing you to our expert trainers for each of these modules.
As mentioned earlier, the updated ITRC Incremental Sampling Methodology Guidance document, known as ISM2, was developed to build upon the 2012 version, ISM1, and to reflect advancements in technology, incorporate lessons learned by practitioners over the past 8 years, and share these case studies that provide insight into the potential applications, benefits, and challenges of the ISM approach. ISM2 contains 9 sections and an appendix with case studies, as well as an update to the statistical simulations contained originally in ISM1. The ITRC ISM2 training modules will not cover all the sections of the guidance document, so again, we strongly encourage you to visit the web-based document for ISM2 as well as ISM1 and explore all the tools and resources that are available there.
The iSIM2 Update team created this training as a series of 6 modules. These are designed to be standalone modules to help participants understand specific components of ISM. These modules can be viewed separately or in any order preferred by the participants. Module 1 provides an overview to orient participants to the concept of ISM and the guidance document. Module 2 discusses the importance of small-scale and large-scale heterogeneity. Module 3 recognizes the common statistical misconceptions and pitfalls in sample planning and analysis and how to avoid them. Module 4 will provide a variety of examples and techniques to help you understand field sampling methods used in ISM. Module 5 provides comprehensive review of lab and analytical side of ISM and how it impacts the quality of your results. And Module 6 is your go-to resource for what you need to know about using ISM data in risk assessment and risk-based decision making. Also, please don't forget that the ISM1 team developed a 2-part training that is still available on CLUIN. These trainings provide additional in-depth information on ISM for those wanting to dig deeper into the sampling methodology. As part of the ISM2 document and training development, our team reviewed these trainings and determined that these resources are still relevant and current. The ISM2 update team is excited to present these new training opportunities for you and hope you can use the information to help with your environmental sites. Please remember to visit the full guidance document for all tools and resources developed by the ISM2 update team. Hello, my name is Caroline Gelanti, one of the co-team leaders for ISM2. And thank you very much for joining us for our training presentation today. In Module 4, we will be going over the field sampling protocols and considerations to take when collecting incremental samples. This topic is further discussed in Section 4 of the ISM2 update document now available on the ITRC website. Our trainer for Module 4 is Todd Miller. If you're interested in reading more about his expertise, you can visit his bio through the link at the bottom of this page. Let's move on to our next slide, and I will pass off the presentation to Todd.
Thank you, Caroline. Hello, I'm Todd Miller, a senior geologist with Kennedy Jenks Consultants, and today I'll be presenting the field sample collection module of the internet-based training for the ISM2 document. In this session, we will discuss field planning and preparation, including review of the work plan and field program checklist, site and DU locating techniques, field sampling techniques, including tool selection and mass reduction, and sample handling. During this presentation, some of you might have a question about the whys or hows of determining the number of increments in a decision unit. Since this presentation is focused on preparation and field implementation, we will not be discussing that subject. Those topics are part of the DQO and work plan process and are covered in Section 3 of the ISM2 document and in Training Module 3. So for more information on those topics, please refer to those resources. Prior to mobilizing to the field, the team will want to review the work plan to understand how decision units correspond to each other, the number of increments to be collected in the decision units, and the overall sampling objectives. Review of the work plan should also confirm that sampling equipment is appropriate for the media and the sampling environment, and should identify what equipment will be used to locate the decision units and the increments in the field. The field team should also confirm that the project schedule is adequate for successful implementation and understand if specific client or agency notifications are required. While reviewing the work plan, the team should create a checklist to help for the sampling event. The first page of Section 4 of the ISM2 document provides a checklist that you can use as a template. The checklist should cover reviewing the DQOs to understand how the sampling will meet work plan objectives and how the data collected will further the conceptual site model and understanding of the site. As mentioned previously, more information about DQOs can be found in Section 3 of the ISM2 document and in Training Module 3. The field checklist should summarize critical information about the decision units, such as the size and location on site, depth intervals to be sampled, and known or possible physical constraints that need to be taken into account for sampling. The program checklist should include information about increments, such as the number of increments per decision unit, the number of replicates, and the need for early collection of those replicates in the sampling process, and also knowing the frequency. The sampling path or path of travel for collecting the increments that ensures unbiased results, and the bulk sample size to be collected for each decision unit. As part of the planning process, the team should confirm a few items with the laboratory: special handling and sampling procedures, the sample processing steps, and the analytical procedures to confirm that they meet the regulatory requirements, selected sample containers are appropriate, and that QC procedures will meet the QAP requirements. So let's move into our first knowledge check. So which of these factors is important to understand when preparing for an ISM sampling event? The sample path that provides biased high results. B, volume size and number of increments per decision unit. Or C, collecting replicates late in the process for better quality control. And I'll give you a few seconds to select the buttons below. All right, so the correct answer is B, volume and size number of increments per decision unit. For the sampling path, item A, we want to select a sampling path that presents unbiased results. And if you selected C, collecting replicates should be done early in the process. So as described in section 4.2, field planning should also include a review of the staffing plan and general site reconnaissance. Although ISM can be performed by a single individual, a two or three person team is often more efficient. Ideally, one person lays out the decision units and the increment locations, while a second person collects the samples, collects the increments, and a third person manages the increments, the bulk samples, and the sample containers. For training, staff should have a basic understanding of the sampling objectives and protocols specific to ISM, and understand some of the differences between traditional and ISM sampling techniques. For example, are you aware that there's no need to decon your sampling equipment between collecting increments? The program manager should also confirm that client or site-specific training is provided to staff prior to mobilization. Site conditions should also be confirmed prior to mobilization, as conditions can change between the time the work plan is written and field implementation. The photos on the right show three very different sites, each having a different access and sampling constraints. Confirming site conditions prior to mobilization through either a field reconnaissance or updated aerial photographs could result in re-evaluation of either the sampling tools or techniques that will be used, or how the site is or DU is accessed for sampling. As described in section 4.2.3, planning should also take into account the number of increments per bulk sample. The two figures on the right show two DUs of the same size, one with a small number of increments and one with a larger number of increments. The size of the bulk samples from these two decision units could be significantly different, or the increment sizes can be adjusted to generate the same size bulk sample from both decision units. The size of the increments to be collected will impact the sampling tools needed, as well as the sample container. And sample containers should be selected based on the estimated volume of the bulk sample, constituents of concern to be analyzed, and storage and shipping constraints. In most cases, a 1 gallon resealable plastic bag or a 5 gallon plastic bucket will be appropriate as a bulk sample container. Field planning should also cover documentation for sample nomenclature, analytical requirements, and sample preparation procedures, and other items that may need to be collected or be included in the chain of custody. Planning also needs to include schedule considerations. The field team should discuss and understand the number of bulk samples to be collected each day and sample storage, as well as how to manage those field samples in the event of a significant sampling delay. Subsurface investigation planning is described in section 4.2.4 of the document. And in addition to obtaining good spatial coverage, good vertical representation of the decision unit adds an additional element to the planning process. As subsurface investigations are inherently labor and equipment intensive, the additional planning should help minimize field time. Section 4.3 of the document describes field locating techniques. Depending on the environment, locating decision units can be a simple task or complicated. For decision units that are in defined areas, such as a parking lot, or possibly structurally defined, such as a riverbank, and of a simple shape like a rectangle, boundaries can be located and gridded with a field tape. However, broad-shaped DUs, or those that are in heavily vegetated or uneven or even open terrain, a GPS unit might be needed. The field team should be prepared to mark the boundaries of the decision units and the increments with spray paint or pinned flags or survey stakes, depending on the terrain features and the surface type. When DUs are square or rectangular in shape, spacing between the increments is relatively straightforward. For example, the graph on the right shows a decision unit that is divided into 8 rows and 7 columns, giving us 56 increments, with one increment collected from each grid cell. The preferred method is to collect increments from the same location within each grid cell, which is known as systematic random sampling. Systematic random sampling produces equally spaced increments such that the entire decision unit is equally represented and there are no significant physical gaps between increment locations. As previously discussed, the goal of increment spacing is to represent each part of the DU equally without bias. Other techniques such as simple random or random within grid sampling can also produce unbiased representation of the decision unit, but can result in large spatial gaps between the increment locations, are therefore less desirable. For more information about these two sampling techniques, please refer to Section 3.1 of the ISM2 document. For odd-shaped DUs, cell size and shape can be adjusted such that each cell is approximately the same size or area, but note that row lengths and increments per row may vary throughout the decision unit. In these cases, ensuring equal spacing of the increments will require some pre-planning. Decision units and increment locating can be performed using basic field equipment, such as field tapes or conventional survey equipment, or GIS-based systems. GIS-based tools can be used with a cell phone or tablet and a GPS backpack unit, depending on the need for accuracy, to establish field locations. The GIS-based positioning applications can be used in the field to record the decision unit boundaries and increment locations, or the locations can be established in advance of sample collection, placed on a site map and that map uploaded to your application, which then can be used by the field team to confirm the locations of the decision units and increments at the time of sampling. Pre-planning the path of travel for increment collection will help to save time in the field. The path is best selected during planning stages to meet DQOs. However, the team should review the selected path of travel after mobilizing and prior to sample collection to confirm it's still appropriate. So now we're going to play a short video here showing a ISM surface soil sampling process actually taking place. You'll note that in the video, one member is laying out the pin flags for each location. A second person is collecting the increments, and a third person is collecting those increments into a single container. Note that equipment decontamination is not occurring between increments. Now, this video has been sped up a little bit, but you can show that the video will show you that an ISM surface soil sampling technique can occur relatively quickly. So in the planning process, if you're trying to decide between 30 or 50 or 100 increments, timing for a surface soil sampling investigation probably is not a major factor. What tools are we going to use to collect our ISM samples? Well, the tools aren't much different than roughly the same as what you use in a traditional sampling program. As described in Section 4.4, the sampling tools selected for the project will depend on the media being sampled, the sample depths or depths, and the volume of soil to be collected. Sampling tools can consist of hand augers and slide hammers, or power tools such as rotohammers or vibratory probes, or even large equipment like such as drill rigs. As you're selecting the sampling tools, keep in mind that the tool should be capable of collecting a consistent volume for each increment. Typically, scoops are not preferred in the field, as they can be difficult to maintain a consistent increment. So let's talk about sampling methods real quick. So different sampling methods will be needed for different conditions and objectives. As previously discussed, surface soil sampling can be accomplished by starting in one corner or end of the decision unit and collecting your increments systematically throughout the decision unit. Stockpile sampling can be accomplished in several manners and needs to consider the source of the material and how the stockpile was created. One of the best options to coordinate sampling during the formation of the stockpile. As the stockpile is being created, there is generally good access to sampling each portion of the stockpile over time. This provides access to the entire stockpiled material and ensures representativeness. Sampling the stockpile while it's being created does require that we know the approximate volume of the stockpile to be generated and the number of increments we want in that stockpile prior to proceeding. Other options include moving a stockpile that's already been created and collecting your increments while it's being moved. And again, that provides us good access to all of the material in the stockpile and ensures representatives. Another option, as shown in the graph here, is a stockpile can be laid out flat and gridded as if you were sampling a surface soil decision unit. Excavation sampling can be completed by assigning different DUs to the different portions of the excavation. As shown in the graph on the lower right here, we have a different decision unit for each sidewall and a different decision unit for the base of the excavation. Or we could assign the entire excavation to be a single decision unit. Just remember that for each decision unit, we're going to want to collect between 30 and 100 increments. Subsurface sampling is typically completed using continuous cores, and with ISM, that would be a requirement. Ideally, to be representative, the entire core should be considered an increment. As shown in the figure on the right here, we have a number of borings, and let's assume that those borings are sampling from surface down to 10 feet below ground surface. We have a series of borings throughout our decision unit, and the core from each one of those borings would represent an increment. So you can imagine if you're combining all of those increments, all of those cores together to form your bulk sample, it's going to result in an ISM a bulk sample with a very large volume, making logistics such as field storage, shipping, and laboratory processing problematic or impracticable. So in those cases, we want to consider mass reduction techniques. So mass reduction techniques can consist of wedge sampling, core slice sampling, or plug sampling. So wedge sampling is where the field staff would cut a wedge from the entire vertical extent of the core from bottom to top and use that wedge to represent your increment for that location. Wedge sampling is preferred because the resulting increment represents the entire vertical distribution of the core. However, it may still produce a bulk sample that is too large. In those cases, we can look at core sampling, where a slice of the core is collected at vertical increments throughout the core, and those slices are then used combined to represent your increment. Or we can look at plug sampling, where plugs are collected along the entire vertical length of the core, and those plugs are then combined to represent your increment. Plug sampling and core slice sampling are good alternatives, but will result in vertical sections of the core being unrepresented. So let's have another knowledge check real quick. So which of the following factors will impact how increments are collected? Is it A, your soil type, B, terrain, C, specified sampling equipment, D, mass reduction techniques to be used, or E, all of the above? And I'll give you a few seconds to answer. So it looks like most of you have gotten the answer right. It would be all of the above. All those factors are important and will impact how increments are being collected in the field. So section 4.6 of the document also provides more information about sample handling. A few key points here. The primary concern for sample storage is the large sample volume. Significant storage space using multiple coolers or even a field refrigerator is typically needed. And increments collected during a single day do not need to be cooled. However, bulk samples once processed and labeled should be stored in a cooled ice chest or a refrigerator and should remain cold until the sample is received by the laboratory. Note that shipping large volumes of bulk samples requires good coordination with the shipping company and the laboratory receiving the samples. And large volumes of ice or freezer packets will be needed for the multiple coolers. Shipping weights should also be considered when designing your sampling program. The use of hazardous materials in the field, such as using methanol to preserve samples for VOC investigations, can result in shipping restrictions. So the field team will need to make sure that they're familiar with and follow hazardous materials shipping regulations if you're going to use preservatives in the field. Because ISM processing can take several days by the laboratory, sample holding times should be considered in the logistics during planning when consulting with the laboratory. If you have an analysis that's going to require a quick turnaround, you will need to coordinate that with the laboratory so they're aware of what to do once a sample is received. So after reading section 4, the following questions should be able to be answered to ensure proper field preparation and implementation. So have you allocated the appropriately trained staff to execute the task? Have you identified site-specific means of marking out your decision units? Have you calculated the increment size based on the sample design total volume and identified the appropriate tools to obtain each increment from the required depth? And assess if mass reduction techniques will be needed during increment collection. Have you requested or obtained sample containers specific to ISM? Considered the added resources for sample storage, such as ice and coolers or a refrigerator? Have you communicated to the laboratory the required processing and QC requirements for the chain of custody? And have you checked the site conditions prior to mobilization using photos, visual observations, or other means to confirm site access and that sampling equipment are appropriate and you have access to the site and the decision units? And with that, I'll turn it back over to Caroline.
Thank you, Todd. That was wonderful. Just as a reminder, ICRC archives all of its training, and each of these modules for ISM2 will be archived individually as a standalone module. So that will be a great resource for you to review, go back to for on-demand viewing. And also, if you have additional time or are looking for additional training opportunities, please also go to ClueIn for the archived trainings and to see what other courses might be of interest to you. At this time, we are going to open up the question and answer portion of our training today. At any time, you can type in your questions in the Q&A pod at the bottom right corner of your screen. We will do our best to get through as many of these questions as we can. Okay, so there is one question that was asked, Todd. Most of our contractors default to 30 increments per SU. What reasons might we want to collect more than the minimum 30 increments?
Sure. So great question, and it's actually a question that gets asked quite a bit. So, if you look at Training Module 3 and Section 3 of the document, and we look at our DQOs, the more increments you collect, the better your statistics become, the better your confidence interval on the result, and the more confidence you have that the result from your ISM sample is a true representation of your decision unit. So obviously there's always a trade-off between time and cost of collecting a number of increments and how many increments do you collect. And so that's really part of your DQO process, but just defaulting to 30 doesn't always make sense when you look at it from a statistical perspective.
Great. Thank you, Todd. And one more question. How are triplicates collected for subsurface soils?
So for subsurface soils, strictly speaking, a triplicate would be three borings placed right next to each other within a couple of feet. There have been folks that have talked about collecting, triplicate samples from the same boring, but if you think about the ISM process, we want the entire core to represent a single increment. So, the proper answer is it would be multiple borings within a couple of feet of each other to represent your triplicate.
Awesome. Thank you. And I have another subsurface investigation question. For subsurface investigation, how does one account for variable percent recovery per borehole increment?
That's a great question. That comes out with, any type of subsurface sampling. We always want to try to maximize the amount of recovery. Typically with subsurface investigations, you're going to get what you get, and there are ways to maximize your recovery, shorter drill strings. You might have a 5-foot drill string, but you might choose to advance it in 2-foot increments to, maximize your amount of recovery. But certainly whatever you get out of the boring is what you are going to use for your increment selection. So it all gets combined into one increment. And the process for maximizing recovery through whether it be an ISM or a traditional sampling methodology would be the same.
Okay, and one on wedge sampling. When doing wedge sampling, what tools do you suggest to use to be able to collect identical wedges between cores?
Oh, great question. That's a difficult one because there aren't really too many tools that are defined for that. It also depends on the type of media that you have. Really what we try to do, if you're using a direct push method and you get acetate sleeves with your soil samples, it's very easy to mark out a area to cut the acetate sleeve and then the soil from. If you're having to extrude it from a 5-foot core barrel sampler, that becomes a little more difficult. But really what we've done in the past is to use a tool that will simply measure a certain diameter on the outside of the core and then cut that core, all the way to the middle such that you get a pie-shaped wedge. Now, you can do that with a knife or a box cutter, and again, depending on the material, if it's a clay, a silt, a sand, obviously sand and gravel becomes a little more difficult.
Okay, I do have one more question that seems to be more geared towards our lab side and our analytical side, but it does have some field collection applications too. So maybe you and Mark Bruce can both tag team this question.
Sure.
The question is, I have serious resistance to accept this procedure for VOC mainly on the surface and on warm and windy condition days. So do you have anything that you'd like to add?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you're collecting surface soil or subsurface soil samples for VOCs, you're going to collect those samples regardless, whether it's a traditional sample or a ISM. With an ISM sampling event, if you're going to collect surface soil samples, you're going to take a small core, and you can use something like an on-core sampler. And you're going to collect that core and put it right into a vial that contains methanol. And so you're immediately collecting a sample and immediately preserving that sample. So there really isn't a difference between that and collecting the sample and with say a brass tube or some other sampling device and putting it into a glass jar or sealing the ends of the ends of your tube or your acetate liner or whatever you're collecting the sample with. So as long as you've planned it out in advance and you know that with ISM we can use, a plug sampler and collect the increment and place that increment into a bottle containing methanol, that gives you the ability to get the same level of quality as, you know, other traditional methods in collecting discrete samples. And Mark will cover that a little bit in his presentation as well.
Thank you, Todd. So at this point in time, we're going to be moving forward into our next module. I would like to say thank you to all of our participants today, and thank you, Todd, for being here and for your contributions to our ITRC document and all of our other trainers that are answering questions directly now in our Q&A chat box. If your question was not answered directly during this live Q&A, we will be doing our best to keep up with the questions throughout the presentation with all of our presenters that are here with us now live. And if we have time and it fits into our discussion during a later module, we may be able to ask them during the live Q&A then as well.
Hi, this is Troy Keith again with the Tennessee Department of Environment and Conservation, one of the ISM co-leads, and want to welcome you to Module 5 of the ISM 2 training. In this module, we will cover ISM laboratory techniques that help to maintain sample representativeness and improve precision through the use of appropriate sample processing options. The trainer for Module 5 is Dr. Mark Bruce. In addition to helping with the ISM 2 update, Mark also participated in drafting ISM 1, and so he has a wealth of experience with ISM and laboratory techniques in general. And if you'd like to read more about his expertise, you can access his bio with the link at the bottom of the page. And now I will pass it off to Mark.
Thank you very much, Troy. So for those of you who have followed along both in the previous module today and some of the earlier modules, you'll realize that there is a lot of effort that the ISM practitioners put into the planning and developing the sampling plan and going out and actually implementing that plan in the field. So we want to make sure that we maintain that same level of effort when it comes to sample processing. So there are three main areas that we're going to touch on in this module. We're going to talk for the planners on how you go about selecting the processing options that are right for your particular project to manage the microscale heterogeneity that is still present in the samples even after they're sent to the lab. And we need to be cognizant of how we're going to preserve the representativeness for the constituents of concern. From a laboratory perspective, we're going to talk about how to implement those different sample processing options, and then we'll finish up with a little bit of quality assurance, quality control at the end of the module. So in terms of selecting the sample processing options, the project team needs to choose what works for that particular project. So we're going to be talking about the site characteristics. What are your objectives for the site characterization event? The contaminants of concern. Are we talking surface or subsurface soil? What are the contaminant release mechanisms? And what are the data usage scenarios? And each of these influences what are the optimal processing options. We're going to be touching on moisture management, particle size selection, particle size reduction, and the digestion or the extraction. So first off, I don't expect you to be able to read this flowchart, but it's here to emphasize that there are choices to be made. We don't have a universal ISM sample process that works for all projects. So we're going to be talking about, well, how do you choose in order to avoid producing data that might lead you to making a decision error? So we're going to start off with air drying, and we want to do air drying when it's appropriate to do so. When we can, it actually reduces the cost of subsequent sample processing. So for surface soils that have already been exposed to air, then air drying isn't going to change anything from a chemical constituent perspective. It facilitates disaggregation and sieving. The contaminants do need to be stable. So we want to consider the possibility of volatilization losses or whatever the boiling point, how strongly bound the contaminants of concern are to the soil particles. So surface soils are usually stable because they've already been exposed to air. Subsurface are frequently stable, but we need to consider the possibility that some of the lower boiling contaminants might be weakly absorbed on the particles, which if that's the case, then we do have the option of doing a two-dimensional slab cake subsample on the as-received sample. It kind of eliminates a few of the process options, but oftentimes it's the best way to make sure that we don't introduce an unintended bias. Disaggregation, it just basically means breaking up the soil clumps. So this is something that we kind of need to do before we move on to other steps in the process. And that can be done using perhaps a coffee chopper or the number of other mechanisms. Particle size selection is really important for some particular projects. And when we do that, we actually change what goes through the analysis process. And we want to use the project objectives to determine if any particle size selection or sieving is appropriate. For example, one of the operational definitions of soil is all particles that are smaller than 2 millimeters. If that's one of the objectives, then we use a number 10 sieve at the lab. On the other hand, if we're more focused on particles that are likely to stick to a child's hands and be incidentally ingested, then it might be more appropriate to use a number 100 sieve. Milling is another decision point. For stable analytes, milling improves precision and can have minimal bias. You can see in the graph on the right that samples that have been through milling have significantly smaller relative standard deviations. So with the benefit of that better precision, we want to consider, okay, is this the type of sample that will benefit from that? And that benefit most commonly occurs when the nugget effect is high. In other words, we have higher concentration particles and we want to try to make those smaller and more evenly distribute them throughout the sample. We do need to take into account if we're working with very thermally labile contaminants of concern, there's the possibility that heat formation during the milling process may thermally decompose some of them. Also, most of the mills that are available do contain some metal, so we need to take into account what's the possibility of actually contaminating the sample, for example, with iron or chromium. And lastly, for some risk assessment purposes, releasing the metals that are locked up inside of the hard crystalline particles might be considered not something that we want to do or a high bias for the particular intended use of the data. So let's go into a knowledge check. So my question for you is, what are the most practical processing options when air drying is not appropriate? Select all of the applicable options. Is it disaggregation, sieving, milling, or 2D slab cake subsampling? And I see that that many of you were listening earlier when I talked about sometimes we have a need to actually skip the sieving and milling steps and air drying steps for some particular project objectives. So the correct answer is 2D slab cake subsampling. So, and there are some instances, in fact, the Hawaii Department of Health has actually identified a few of those instances on a regular basis. So let's go on. So now I have a survey for you as we look forward into the remainder of this training module. So my question for you is, or statement is, ISM principles can be applied when testing for volatile organic compounds. Is this true or false? And I see from the survey results that most of you are aware that we actually can apply ISM principles to volatile organic compounds. The process is different, and we're actually going to touch on that next. So as Todd mentioned, with regard to a question from the module 4, essentially what we do is we use a large-scale version of EPA method 5035, which is the methanol preservation option in that particular method. So when ground shipment from the site to the lab is an option, we generally prefer using a single large bottle with an appropriate amount of methanol. So for example, if it's 30 increments, 5 grams per increment, that would be 150 grams of soil. So that leads us to 150 milliliters of methanol. Now, because of a DOT restriction, we're limited to 30 milliliters or less of methanol in an individual container when we want to do easy air shipment. So if we need to employ air shipment, then we typically resort to a medium-sized methanol bottle. So for example, here we might have 25 milliliters of methanol. So we could put five gram plugs into one 60 mil vial and then repeat that multiple times until we accumulate all of the increments for that particular decision unit. We ship those all back to the lab, and then at the lab, they'll pull out an aliquot of each of the individual methanol extracts and then combine those to produce an analysis that actually represents the entire decision unit. So now let's turn our attention to how a lab goes about implementing these various sample processing options. So we're going to look at air drying, disaggregation, sieving, milling, subsampling, and then digestion and extraction. So in terms of sample conditioning via air drying, we typically do this at room temperature, and the easiest is to spread out on a pan in a ventilation hood and let the water evaporate to produce the dry, crushable dirt clods. When we're all done, then we're going to move into disaggregation. But I want to point out on the right-hand side of this slide is a more modern adaptation called an air drying tower. And you can see that we've got racks of multiple samples. And shown on the right-hand edge, you can actually see filters that are built into the door. On the backside, out of sight in this picture, are a series of filters that are fans that pull air across the samples. So we get very even airflow, tends to dry much more quickly, and because we're pulling the air through a filter, we minimize the chances of contamination. On the disaggregation front, we're going to be basically busting up the dirt clods produced in the air drying step, and this could be as simple as gently crushing them with a mortar and pestle, but being careful not to actually mill the hard crystalline rocks and sand grains, putting it into a coffee chopper, or shown on the right is a rotary hammer disaggregator that basically has a spinning mechanism inside of that housing, and it basically bangs the dirt clods around, and then the soil dust falls out the bottom. Sieving is used to accomplish particle size selection. We touched on this earlier. The most common is to use the number 10 sieve to remove everything less than 2 millimeters, a variety of other sieve options, and for labs that support ISM projects, they usually have a wide range of sieves that are available to match your particular project needs. Particle size reduction or milling is most commonly accomplished with one of two options, the puck mill shown on top or the ball mill on the bottom. And EPA method 8330B for energetics describes the use of the puck mill, and it has a significant improvement in precision, particularly when microscale heterogeneity is a significant issue for the sample as it comes in from the field. Ball mill is a less expensive but a little bit less rigorous option, but it's still suitable for many applications, and it provides a moderate improvement in precision. So we need to choose the milling equipment based on what are the analytes, the concentration of interest, and what the mill materials are. So on this next slide, we actually have a short video of the use of a puck mill. And in this video, we will see the analyst putting the sample into the bowl of the puck mill, and then putting the cover onto that, taking it over to the shaker mechanism and inserting it. Typically we let it go for about a minute, and then after a minute we pull it out and let it cool. In this example, we're going to kind of short circuit the process and actually illustrate dumping the sample out. Oftentimes there's at least three cycles of mill and cool, mill and cool. And the cooling steps are done to help manage to make sure that we don't have a runaway temperature. So let's do another knowledge check at this point and ask you, what is the primary benefit of milling? Is it to improve analyte recovery, improve precision, or to improve the QC results? Okay. And I see that most everybody has identified the correct answer as it improves the precision. All right, so on this next slide, we actually have a little demonstration video of a two-dimensional slab cake, which is used to produce analytical subsamples. And in this particular video, what we demonstrate is dividing the sample up into a grid-like pattern, similar to what gets used in collecting a surface soil. And we want to make sure that we collect at least 30 increments. It's okay to do more. In fact, some projects actually require it. We're using a blunt end scoop with sides so that we get more or less equal representation of the top and the bottom of the slab cake. In this particular instance, we were targeting a 10 gram subsample weight. And you can see that in this particular instance, the analyst got it on the first try. Sometimes we come up a little bit short, in which case it's okay to go ahead and randomly choose a few more increments to bring the sample weight up to the proper amount. After collecting the subsamples, and typically we head to either a digestion for metals or an extraction for organics, larger subsample masses tend to be more representative. For most organic methods, we're usually already doing at least 10 grams, if not 15, 20, or 30 grams. Historically, metals digestions have usually only worked with 1 to 2 gram subsamples, and if there's still microscale heterogeneity present at this point in the process, that can be a problem, more likely to occur if milling was not selected. So in that case, a number of ISM supporting labs have actually scaled up their metals digestion to work with 10 gram subsamples. And when that is one of your project options, that's an appropriate discussion to have with the laboratory. For other inorganic parameters, let's say for example cyanide, and some of the other wet chem parameters that haven't been scaled up, definitely need to have a discussion with your laboratory to see what the options are there. So as we near the end of this module, we're going to touch on quality assurance. And there is an ongoing effort to develop surrogates that can be added at the beginning of the ISM sample processing to monitor for potential bias that might be the result of either the sample matrix or the sample preparation steps. Now, currently, we don't add surrogates at the beginning of the ISM processing. It's more likely to be added prior to extraction or digestion. So at this point, there are a number of labs working with the Department of Defense to try to develop a suitable surrogate that can be added at the beginning. And shown here is a picture from one of those efforts where a white powder containing semi-volatile organic surrogates was sprinkled onto the surface of a soil sample at the beginning of the air drying step. And there is an effort led by the Department of Defense to actually come up with labeled PAH surrogates that can be used to track analyte integrity through the entire ISM process. The addition of traditional solvent-based surrogate solutions just prior to air drying, it overestimates the losses of the lower boiling organics because there just isn't much absorbance between that scenario and the soil particles. So that's not a good choice. So to wrap up for this module, to summarize to this point, there's been a lot of decision unit designation under the planning step and choosing the right selection, tool selection for collecting those increments, making sure that the staff is appropriately trained, selecting the right sample processing options, which we talked about earlier, determining what your QA/QC needs are, and then we just go ahead and actually do both in the field and at the lab in terms of implementing those processing options. And if we carry all of this out, we have a much better chance of actually succeeding of producing data that represents the actual site conditions, which then hopefully leads us to making better decisions with regard to the site. So with that, I'll hand it back over to the moderator.
Thank you very much, Mark. Again, we would love to hear back from you today. Feedback's very important. It helps us, improve our products in the future and make any additions or corrections to existing products. Also, as mentioned earlier, by filling out the feedback form, that allows you to get credit for attending today's session. IT archives all the training classes, so you can always go back and revisit that on CLUIN, where this module and others will have been recorded. So at this time, we're going to open it up to any questions that you have. Feel free to type in the Q&A box at the bottom of your screen. And we'll start off with Mark, could you clarify on whether or not to mill?
Okay, Okay, milling is most beneficial when we have significant microscale heterogeneity, in other words, nuggets of high concentration particles. And the classic example is for explosives, when we got unburdened bits of TNT, for example, and we run it through the mill, it makes those particles smaller and then distributes them better, so we get better precision. In instances where we might thermally degrade some of the analytes, then milling is not appropriate. There are other instances where the contaminants of concern are fairly evenly distributed, in which case milling might not hurt, but it's also not going to help.
Okay. Very closely related, since both methods effectively reduce particle size, what are the advantages, if any, of using a ball mill over a puck mill?
Well, the ball mill tends to be a lower temperature process because it's less aggressive, so we don't build up as much heat due to friction. Also, the equipment is less expensive, so it might be more readily available amongst the labs that support ISM. So it tend to be a little bit less expensive.
Okay. I think I understand this question. So when a lab is using a one-to-one methanol to soil ratio, some of the increments are aggregated in the field. So does that interfere with the one-to-one, or are you, I guess, ideally you're just putting the entire core into the methanol bottle, so you're not actually aggregating at all for VOCs?
Well, typically for volatiles, we're using, again, the 5 or perhaps 10-gram plug samplers, and we're maintaining the 1-to-1 ratio of grams of soil to milliliters of methanol. So that's a part of the method, the chemistry of method 5035. We are not changing that. What we're doing is just scaling it to a larger sample mass.
Okay. So VOCs seem to be a hot topic here. So milling is not really a viable preferred option for VOCs. So elaborating on that question, what group would you separate between using the VOC preserved versus milling, air drying with heat, without heat? So for example, using semi-volatile like naphthalene, which is both semi and volatile, would that represent a good mm-hmm. breakpoint?
Naphthalene is one of those compounds that can either be done as a volatile or as a lighter weight semi-volatile. And a very common question, if you're doing volatiles, then it may be more appropriate to actually handle it in the volatile section. We have done naphthalene as a semi-volatile in surface soils and have gotten very good results, because if it's still present as a surface soil, it means that it's strongly adhered to those particles, so air drying at the lab isn't going to cause any additional loss. On the other hand, if it's a subsurface soil, then we don't necessarily have quite as much assurance that it's going to be strongly adhered to the particles. So in that scenario, it might be better to do it as a volatile using the methanol preservation technique.
Okay. And I guess it's worth pointing out that there is a list of constituents that are amenable for air drying versus those that are more susceptible to loss, and that is available through the document. So, last question. Since not every lab is necessarily set up for ISM, how do you go about picking out a lab? Are there specific qualifications that are published or, you know, listed in their credentials?
Well, yeah, most certification programs don't look in great detail at ISM sample processing. The Department of Defense ELAB program is probably the one that has done the best in that area. So that's where a DOD lab that has actually had their ISM process looked at would be one way of doing that. But there are a lot of non-DOD labs out there that provide ISM services. And that's where, you know, talking with the lab to see what specific auditors have actually evaluated their ISM services.
So basically just reach out to your lab and ask if they are mm-hmm. familiar with ISM and set up to do so. Okay.
Right.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Mark. And with that, we'll move on.
Hello, my name is Caroline Gelanti. I'm one of the co-team leaders for the ISM2 update team, and thank you for joining us for this training presentation today. The Module 6 training focuses on the content of Section 8 of the ISM2 document. Module 6 addresses key issues risk assessors should consider when planning for the use of ISM data for risk assessment and provides guidance for use of ISM data in risk assessment with risk-based decision-making. As in previous training modules, links will be included on the slides to redirect you to specific section locations for additional detail on the topics. Our Module 6 trainers are Tamara Sorrell and Karen DiBiasio. If you'd like to read more about their expertise, you can access their bios through the link at the bottom of the page. Let's move on to our next slide, and I'll pass the presentation off to Karen.
Looks like we're having some technical difficulties.
Yeah, sorry. It looks like we're muted still. Karen.
Oh, sorry about that. Okay. I apologize. I'll start over. Thanks, Caroline. I'm Dr. Karen DiBiasio, a toxicologist and risk assessor for the California Department of Toxic Substances Control, or DTSC. As Caroline mentioned, Section 8 in today's module will cover some planning and use aspects of ISM for risk assessment and risk-based decision making. As in previous training modules, links will be included in the slide to direct you to specific locations within our ISM2 guidance document. For example, this slide is linked to Section 8. Section 8 relies heavily on earlier sections and is a go-to resource for use of ISM data in risk assessment. Section 8 focuses on the generation and use of ISM data for both human health and ecological risk assessment. Today, we will touch only on select high-level topics in this presentation, and those key issues are planning, development of exposure point concentrations, and risk-based decision-making. Now we're going to take a poll, and the first question is, have you ever used ISM data for risk assessment? And the second question, were you aware that you can generate a reliable UCL to use as an exposure point concentration with 3 replicates? I'll give you a minute to respond to this. Okay, I'm going to end the poll. And I see about half of you have used ISM data for risk assessments for your projects. And a little more than half of you were aware that you can generate a reliable UCL to to use as an exposure point concentration with three replicates, and we'll be discussing this further in this presentation. Now I'll turn it over to Tamara.
Thanks, Karen. So as I'm sure you expect we're going to say, absolutely, you can use ISM for risk assessment. It gives you a very scientifically defensible exposure concentration, and it makes your risk assessment much more reliable. One thing to note is that your concentration that you get will be your exposure point concentration, but that in order to generate an upper concentration limit for use of your exposure concentration, you do need three replicates. You can't do it with just one ISM sample. So as with risk assessment in any application, you need to start at the outset with a good understanding of your nature and extent of contamination. And there's been a lot of discussion in the previous modules about how to define your decision units. And the only thing to note here in particular is that your exposure area will be your decision unit. So as you are planning your program with the intention of doing risk assessment, there are a number of things that you're going to want to consider. For example, what are your subzones where people or ecological receptors may be exposed? How deep do you need to go? And there's been some discussion previously today about subsurface sampling. And do you have a potential for redevelopment? Your soil may get mixed. What are your boundaries of exposure? Things like that. So those are all things to bear in mind as you define your nature and extent of contamination to make sure that you have the right data then to develop your exposure point concentrations using ISM. The key concept underlying any risk assessment is your conceptual site model, which is an understanding of the relationship between your chemical sources, media, releases, fate and transport pathways, and so on. And you do need to consider both current and future land uses. And one thing just to note here on this graphic is that the CSM occurs, an understanding of that occurs at the outset in the planning part of your project. So it's important to involve your risk team early and to make sure that your CSM is defined, because you could get down maybe around here and find that you don't have the right data. So we don't want anyone to be in that situation. You want the program to proceed effectively. So I'm just going to talk a little bit about the CSM. As I've noted, it is the underlying descriptor of all our relationships. And it is a living concept. As you go through the project and collect more information, you may find that the CSM needs to be adjusted through an adaptive management process, and that is fine. It will help you to see where you have data gaps to make sure that whatever your next collection effort is, you understand what you're looking for. And again, in ISM, the size and distribution of your DUs and your SUs are what is really critical. Here's a couple examples of conceptual site models, how we lay them out and look at them. Many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with these. This one on the screen now is pictorial in nature. This is a great method to use when you have a risk assessment, when you're dealing with the public or with lay people, and you want to be able to describe something readily that anyone can understand. And as you'll note here, there are a variety of pathways, and that we have residential, commercial, as well as ecological receptors. So it kind of covers it all. These types of bubble Charts are also a common way to display your CSM. It's not as sort of intuitive to look at, but it helps to understand. You can kind of go through and figure out exactly what you're looking for and help to define your decision units using this process. You can see for humans or ecological where you're looking. And it's worth pointing out that, you know, typically throughout this training program we've been talking about soil, you can use ISM for other media. You could use ISM, for example, in a, you know, a wetland area that is sediment. I wouldn't particularly recommend it where you have a huge amount of you know, ongoing mixing and you don't have a static situation, but certainly you can use ISM for sediment, and that's often very important in your ecological risk assessments. So here we are again. Your DU is your exposure unit. These are just some examples of different guidance documents. You may be familiar with these. The underlying risk assessment process does not change when you use ISM. So if you are a risk assessor or you work with a risk team, you're not changing your whole paradigm here. All we're really doing is getting a better and more statistically reliable way to calculate your exposure point concentrations. Here are some examples of a somewhat complex site where you might have different ways to lay out your DUs and your SUs. If you have workers, for example, that are exposed in a certain area but not others, that may be one DU. Then perhaps you have outer line areas that might be an attractive nuisance. You could have teams coming on there. We typically evaluate trespassers. Notice here we have a wader. Again, that's going to be a sediment pathway, and that's fine. You can use deep ISM the same way you would for your soil pathways. But then possibly you have some select areas of the site here to the right that are of ecological concern, and you might want to establish a sampling unit to look at those specifically so that you're not mixing and matching your upland areas when you're looking at something like a semi-aquatic animal. So these are just ways to think about it. An SU is really, it's just a subdivision of a DU, and it, you know, defines a different spatial scale for your ISM program. So now we have another poll here. We're interested in learning, does your planning process typically get your risk assessors involved, and if so, at what point do they usually get involved? So I'm seeing a lot of yeses and a lot of beginning and planning, which makes me very happy. Oh, I see it too late. So I'll just put a plug out for the risk assessors in your world. Really can't involve in it too early, and it doesn't even matter whether you're doing ISM. You should absolutely get them involved early so you get the best data. Now Karen's going to talk a little more about the statistical derivation of the exposure point concentrations.
Thanks, Tamara. Now we're going to move from the planning to how to use ISM data in risk assessment, starting with the derivation of the upper confidence limits on the mean, or the UCLs. The UCL typically serves as the exposure point concentration, or EPC, is a key metric in risk assessment. The EPC is a conservative estimate of the mean concentration contacted by the receptor over the daily exposure. The UCL is an estimate of central tendency, an estimate of the mean. It's not an estimate of the upper end of the range. The UCL, as I mentioned, is an estimate of the upper bound limit of the true mean, and it's usually with a specified level of confidence that's typically 95%. You can see more information on ISM UCLs in section 3.2. An ISM 95% UCL is statistically sound. Here's where ISM is so useful. You can get a statistically reliable UCL with as few as 3 samples or replicates, whereas you need at least 10 with discrete grab samples. In addition, the UCL generated with ISM is generally much closer to the measured sample mean than with discrete grab samples and avoids the high bias of typically placed discrete samples. In order to calculate a 95% UCL on the mean, you need at least 3 replicates from a DU. A single ISM sample, or singlet, does not provide a confidence interval for assessing uncertainty in the mean, or provide evidence that the common assumption of relatively low heterogeneity within the DU is met. A single ISM result may be unacceptable to regulators for use in risk assessment. However, a single ISM result might support a risk-based decision when the estimated mean concentration is much greater than or much less than an action level. This slide contains a link to the updated UCL calculator. You can download the file from this link. The updated 95% UCL calculator for ISM was presented and discussed in Module 3 on statistics. The first ISM team built an ISM calculator, and it's been updated since then with improved modeling. You should use this one as opposed to the one from the previous ISM guidance document. You should not use the maximum concentration in risk assessment. You should always use the calculated 95% UCL value from your ISM data as the exposure point concentration, even if it's higher than any of the individual ISM results. In fact, with 3 replicates, the UCL will always exceed the highest individual ISM result. But remember, what we're calculating here is a central tendency, the upper bound estimate of the mean concentration. Using this ISM calculator is quite easy and simple to obtain your 95% UCLs from your ISM data. You can find more information on calculating the ISM 95% UCL in section 3.2.4 of our guidance document. Now, this is a screenshot of the ISM2 95% UCL calculator. What I want to point out here is, now, I don't expect you to be able to read it, but the areas you input information are shaded in green. Most importantly, you need 3 to 6 replicates to calculate a 95% UCL from your ISM data. Section 8 also provides guidance on methods for combining SUs, EUs, or DUs to compute your 95% UCL calculation of your EPC. If each SU or EU has 3 replicate ISM samples with either the same or different spatial coverage, you can use the ISM UCL calculator. If you have triplicates from 1 or more random SUs or EUs and a singlet from all others, then there are methods within Section 8 for calculating your 95% UCL from your ISM data. On some occasions, you may have a very large CMS equivalent EU. Let me explain what I mean by that. Very large EU, think of a farmer plowing his large agricultural field. So his exposure area is this entire very large field, And by CMS equivalent, what I mean is a very homogeneous distribution because of the release mechanism. In this case, a broadcast application of the same pesticides at the same rate to the entire ag field. Now, in the instance when you have a very large CMS equivalent EU, you may collect ISM samples from a random subset of SUs or EUs. And in this instance, there are methods also within Section 8 for calculating your 95% UCL. You can find more information in Section 8.3.3.1. The ISM2 updated 95% UCL calculator does compute weighted 95% UCLs. The topic of weighted 95% UCLs is presented both within Section 6 and Section 8 of our ISM2 guidance document. A weighted 95% UCL is for a DU subdivided into SUs of different sizes. This has been covered within the statistics module 3 of our internet-based training. Volume weighting is what this is taking into account, and this slide is an example as a refresher on the differences from area-weighted as compared to equal-weighted 95% UCL for SUs of different spatial sizes within a larger DU. How could we reduce the uncertainty in the exposure point concentration? As discussed in Module 3 on statistics, the degree of variability, that is the range of data values, expressed as a standard deviation, is a common measure of variability and is used in calculating the UCL. Less variability, that is a lower standard deviation value, gives a narrower mean to UCL width. Tolerance for the mean to UCL confidence interval width can be defined in the DQOs during your systematic planning process. You can find more information on this within Section 3.2.4.3 and Table 3-2-2. What are the causes of variability? Well, the ISM UCL may provide an unreliable estimate of exposure if the data set is from too few increments or replicates, and or the concentration of the contaminant is highly variable across the DU. What is the solution? An additional phase or phases of investigation where this to help achieve a lower relative standard deviation, a narrower confidence interval, and more confidence in the exposure point concentration and risk estimates. This can be achieved by redesigning the DU and or adding more increments per DU. Decision errors stem from UCL uncertainty. The decision error, whether it's an under or overestimation of the mean, correlates to both the direction and magnitude of the uncertainty in the risk estimate. Where the decision threshold is a risk threshold, uncertainty could be critical. Uncertainty could cause the UCL to be below the true mean, as shown in the figure here on the left. The key source of uncertainty is the variance, as we just discussed in the previous slide. And this variance is attributed to the increment variance or coefficient of variation, CV, for the underlying distribution. Also, as just mentioned in the last slide, possible cause of variance and resulting poor representation could be an insufficient number of increments over a large study area or EU. More uncertainty can be tolerated when the COPEC concentrations are far below the risk-based screening levels or action levels, or the calculated risk and hazards are far below the regulatory thresholds, which are typically a 1 times 10 to the minus 6 risk and a hazard index of 1. greater uncertainty in the representativeness of the subset of SUs sampled in an entire very large EU is similarly tolerated when either the COPEC concentrations are far below the risk-based screening levels or action levels, or the calculated risks and hazards are far below the regulatory threshold. The last topic I'll be covering today, is the use of ambient background ISM data in risk assessment. Section 8.4 and also sections 3.1.6.2, section 3.3.4, and section 6.3 contain information on this within our guidance document. As most of you probably know, background concentrations are often used in risk assessment to help refine the COPEC list and more easily identify chemicals related to site releases. Risk assessments may compare the ambient background concentrations to site concentrations to eliminate COPECs either before or after quantitative risk assessment is completed, depending on the stakeholders. You may wonder, and yes, ISM can be used for assessing ambient background soil concentrations of both native metals and ubiquitous anthropogenic chemicals such as dioxins and PAHs, and considered in your risk assessment used for ISM-based study designs. Module 3 on statistics covered factors to consider in collecting ISM background data. And here I want to touch upon the proper planning for background ISM comparisons in risk assessment. Most importantly, we want to have ISM background data to compare to our ISM site data. A key takeaway from this slide is shown on the right here. Your site may have some very neat DUs, rectangular or square, but your background reference area may not allow you to have a DU of that same shape to have a similar volume of soil to include. You may have an irregularly shaped area, or you may have to cobble together smaller, regular, or irregularly shaped areas. What is most important is that your site and background DUs be of approximately, ideally, the same size and volume, but they should definitely be of the same increment density. You want to have the same number of increments per replicate and the same number of replicates per DU for both site and background. Section 8 of ISM-2 includes a brief description of the comparison methods one could use in comparing your background ISM data to your site ISM data. Lastly, the ITRC Soil Background and Risk Team is producing guidance that is expected at the end of 2021, and this will cover ISM background data also. Now I'll turn it back over to Tamara.
So one of the last topics we want to cover here is use of ISM at the end of your project. Maybe you've done a removal action, a treatment, or for whatever reason your remediation is done, and now you're at the point where you want to demonstrate the success of your remedy so you can move ahead with long-term risk management and closure of your site. And you can use ISM to evaluate the residual concentrations at your site the same way you did earlier in the process to do your risk assessment or your nature and extent of contamination. And as you can see here on this little graphic, there might be slightly different geospatial way to do it, but you can still use ISM, and you would just design your sampling plan a little differently, and then you can generate 95% UCL, which is not going to be your maximum, as Karen pointed out, but will give you a statistically defensible estimate of what your true mean worst case would be at the site, and may give you a better closure option when you're comparing to something like a regulatory standard or some kind of cleanup limit that's been developed for your site. So we encourage you to consider using ISM at that point in the process as well. So by now, thank you for sitting through all this, and you've heard a lot about ISM, and there's a lot to digest. And as you would expect, there's still some resistance to using ISM procedures. There are some regulatory and statutory barriers in some states, and there's also a lot of misunderstanding on the part of both agencies as well as the public. Yeah, I'm trying to wrap your head around the fact that you only need, you know, 3 samples that you send to the lab, and that's going to give you something reliable. Some people are opposed to what they consider to be compositing. There's a whole slew of misconceptions. So I would direct you to Section 7 of our tech reg document, which is not covered in the training, but talks about state acceptance. And there's a lot of really good tools in there for addressing these misperceptions and talking to your stakeholder community and trying to get everybody on board for an ISM program should you decide that is what you would like to do. So there are all these resources for you, and we hope that you will take advantage of them and that you've gotten a lot out of this training. And I would certainly like to thank everybody that on this team. This is a great team to work with, and hope that you will reach out to us with your questions and concerns, and that we can continue to work with you to advance ISM tools at your site. So with that, I will turn it back over to Caroline. Thank you.
Thank you, Tamara, and thank you, Karen. That was great. As a friendly reminder, please keep in mind that ITRC archives all of its training classes. So if you find that you have additional time or are looking for additional training opportunities, please visit the CLUIN page and all of the archived trainings that are already there and already available. And again, all of our modules that we have covered with ISM2 will be archived individually, so you can jump straight to the topic of interest to you. At this time, we will be opening questions. At any time, you are able to type in a question that you may have into the Q&A pod in the bottom right corner of your screen. We will do our best to get through as many of these questions as we can. So we do have a few questions already queued up for you guys. To start, in risk assessment, different receptors may be evaluated to different depths, such as construction worker versus groundskeeper versus burrowing animals. In these cases, do we use depth interval specific values rather than full core samples in evaluation?
I'll go ahead and take that. This is Karen. And we want to consider the depth that our receptor will be exposed to. So we may need to divide to have different DUs for the different receptors. If you think about it, we would actually get more representative data if we take the entire depth that the receptor is exposed to, as opposed to just a single smaller interval. So our ISM data, if we're able to collect it from the entire depth of the interval that the receptor would be exposed to, would be the better way to go.
Great. Thank you for that, Karen. And Tamara, what RSD is considered acceptable for risk assessment? What if RSD exceeds the criteria?
I think that question is probably more properly addressed in the statistical section, I mean, I'm assuming that is the RSD for your UCL value. I guess I'm not sure what that is referring to specifically.
This is Karen, and I can take that. So the RSD is between your replicates. So you have three replicates, the triplicates, and your RSD is computed between those. And what we have in our guidance document is a sufficient. There's sufficient homogeneity within your replicates if you have a RSD of 20 to 30%.
Great, thank you for that, guys. All right, and I have another question. Would it be the same approach to break a large DU into smaller DUs? And I believe this was in reference to our discussion on exposure units.
I mean, I can take that. It would really depend on what you anticipate the heterogeneity would be and what your receptors are. If you have a situation where you have a lot of different contamination from, and you expect that it's going to be a huge amount of variability, and you're, for example, putting in single-family homes, you would really need to establish a DU for each of those sub-units if you have a development plan. If you have something that was an agricultural field, maybe, or a munition site where you expect it's fairly consistent, then you could probably do a larger DU and you wouldn't need as many. In the end, like we said, you know, if your RSD comes out high, that's telling you that there's a lot of underlying variability. If you have fairly clustered replicates, then it's not the case. And I've seen both.
Thank you. And let's see, a question that is, oh, I just lost it. A question related to exposure scenario and how it's related to SU size. So for example, if commercial workers' surface exposure is the potential pathway, how big would the SU be within that DU? 1 foot squared, 100 foot squared, 1,000 foot squared? I do not understand how the exposure scenario is related to SU size.
So the SU is the decision, is the scale of the observation, whereas the DU is the scale of the decision. So if you think of it in that terms, it may help you. And the reason for breaking a DU down into SU could be to obtain better geospatial information on your concentrations. So you have that information for risk managers to use in any potential remediation decisions. Or it could be because you have multiple receptors using that area. And for example, you have a small home range ecological receptor and you have a larger home range ecological receptor. So you would have the smaller DUs or SU, let's call it an SU1, just to identify it. I'm sorry, it should be an alphabet. You would have a smaller SU for your smaller home ranges, and you would combine those then to come up with your UCL for your receptor that has the larger home range.
Thank you for that, Karen. For a site with multiple DUs that are delineated by different expected use exposures, for example, construction workers, eco-risks, etc., should triplicates be collected in a DU that is representative of each distinct use exposure, or is this not necessary?
That's a good question, and I'm thinking that it really depends on the sizes of your DUs and the heterogeneity within them. I would have to give that more thought and have more site-specific information in order to really provide a better answer than that.
Entirely understandable. Everything is very dependent on the site-specific criteria that we set. Okay, if you have 3 replicates per DU and 4 DUs, can you calculate a 95% UCL having all the replicates, 12 data points, so i.e. 12 data points?
Was that,
does that make sense? Do you want me to word that?
Could you repeat that, please?
Mm-hmm. If you have 3 replicates per DU and you are evaluating 4 decision units, can you calculate a 95% UCL from those 12 data points?
From a risk perspective, each DU is an area on which you want to make a decision. It is your exposure area. So you would want to have a separate UCL or exposure point concentration from each DU.
But I'm wondering, and I mean, I would consult a statistician on this, if there might be a way to do that. Because, you know, if you do have to consider it all together, it would make sense. I don't know what the statistical tool would be. You know, there's no way to pull apart your replicates once they've gone to the lab.
Mm-hmm.
I would say in general that, you know, to Karen's point, if, you know, you have to size your DUs and EUs based on your ultimate decisions. And so from the way this question reads, it sounds like you're combining 4 decision units into 1. At which point you would have sized it into 1 to begin with if that was appropriate. Otherwise, you could easily be conflating different, like, eco-receptors, human health receptors, et cetera. And so it may not be an apples-to-apples comparison.
Yeah. And our trainer chat box, we are having a statistician weigh in that from a statistics perspective, these points should not pool together because they are not independent. But if you were to use a weighted UCL, that would account for the difference. Okay, and we do have one final question. So if a site is sampled half with ISM sampling and half with discrete sampling, would exposure, but exposure is expected over the whole area, how can this be assessed for a risk assessment? So if we have a site that's been half sampled using ISM protocols and half sampled with discrete sample protocols, would we be able to do a full risk assessment with that data?
You would have to do separate exposure point concentrations based on your ISM data for the area that has that and discrete data for your area that has discrete data, because those values are not comparable directly. They're different measures. One is the measure of the mean, and the other is think of it as the measurement of each of the individual increments within the replicate. So we would be basically comparing apples and oranges. So it's not appropriate to combine those data. That said, a statistician might have a way of handling that, but from a regulator, we usually don't have statisticians available to us within our regulatory settings. So I would really, I would really need to get the weigh-in from a statistician on that.
I mean, I agree, it's apples and oranges, and I'd just like to point out I've also seen sites where ISM was done, but then the background samples were collected as discrete samples, and that's a mess because you really can't compare them.
Okay, thank you for that discussion. So with that, we are going to wrap up our module. A very special thank you to Karen and Tamara for helping us with this presentation today. And big thank you to all of our expert trainers that have participated in today's live internet-based training. And thank you everyone for your contribution to this final ITRC document.